5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Stephen Robert Morse and Seth Porges, the co-directors, producers, writer, etc. They did it all for How to Rob a Bank, the new hit Netflix true crime doc. Seth Porges previously wrote, produced, and directed the documentary Class Action Park, which debuted at number one on its platform, was nominated for a Critics' Choice Documentary Award, and won Best Documentary at the 2021 Hollywood Critics Association Film Awards. A longtime journalist, he formerly worked as an editor at Popular Mechanics and a columnist for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks for being on the show today, Seth.
My pleasure.
And Stephen Robert Morse was nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award for producing Amanda Knox, the 2016 Netflix hit documentary that helped usher in the true crime boom. And I had the director of Amanda Knox on a couple months back, Rod Blackhurst. That was a good show. In 2017, Morse produced, directed, and wrote the critically acclaimed Euro Trump, a film that enabled him to get unprecedented access to Geert Wilders. That film was acquired by Hulu, Vice, and numerous national broadcasters. And in 2020, he directed, wrote, and produced the feature documentary In the Cold Dark Night. Thank you for being on the show today, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about How to Rob a Bank, which is a really interesting look at a shockingly successful bank robber. I feel like modern bank robbers don't get their due. You know, you've got your Billy the Kids and your Bonnie and Clydes and whoever. But nowadays, when somebody really does a good job of ripping off the banks, it kind of, you know, it's like, well, we don't want to talk. We don't like to talk about that. That's not polite. So, Stephen, what was it about the story of the bank robber from the Pacific Northwest who was really good at makeup that drew your attention to this project?
Well, first, I'll have to thank Seth for drawing my attention to that bank robber. Seth can go into that. But I will say that when Seth presented me with this story, there was no doubt in my mind that I had to tell this story with Seth. You know, there was no doubt about it. It was so fascinating.
All right, Seth, let's kick it to you then. What was the what was it about the story that was like, I got to tell this story?
I mean, it was everything about the story. This is the great American myth, is the bank robber, this noble outlaw, you know, back from, again, like the Billy the Kid Wild West days to our guy Scott Scurlock Hollywood in the present. There was something about the story that felt mythological, that felt larger than life. There are elements of the story that you just couldn't believe were real. I mean, this whole movie, this whole story felt like this Hollywood action movie, only it actually happened. And for us, that presented all of these amazing and fascinating themes to explore. You know, we look at the myth of the bank robber and we have this very romantic notion of this victimless crime. You're robbing from the rich, you're robbing from the banks. Who likes the banks, right? And these guys said, well, what if we actually did that? And that was the ultimate question for us. What happens when real people look at a movie, look at a myth, and decide to live it out themselves? What actually happens?
And it's interesting to watch the evolution of. All right, so let's start back at the beginning. What was this guy's deal? What was Hollywood's deal? What was it that in his life that made him turn to crime? I mean, there's this whole fascinating bit early on about his treehouse. He lived in a literal treehouse, which like kind of. I mean, look, I'm watching this and I'm thinking this guy is a. This guy's a child. This guy is a child. He has a literal tree mansion, and he then takes that energy and applies it to, like you say, something a child would see in the movies and think, that looks cool. Let's do that.
Which is making meth, probably, at some point. Yeah. So we start with this career that evolves into bank robbing, right, where he starts by using these profits from meth, I guess, you know, that is made not at the treehouse, near the treehouse. And he's living this life, this fantasy where he thinks he's free. He makes a lot of cash in one go. It doesn't take an incredible amount of time. And then he uses the rest of his time to run around like Tarzan, which is fascinating and something you don't see every day.
Yeah, and this guy was smart. He was no dummy. He was very creative. He was very hardworking. He wasn't like a lazy bank robber or a lazy methamphetamine manufacturer prior to being a bank robber. But he was somebody who I think would really just wanted to live outside of society. He wanted to live outside the system. He wanted to be rebellious in whatever that meant, in whatever way that meant to him at any given point. And I think the idea of living a normal life was worse than death for him. You know, the idea of putting on a suit and tie, getting in the car, going to the office, he probably would have made almost as much money doing that, but that was a fate worse than death. And this was a guy whose entire life was dedicated to this idea of being free. And I use that with air quotes or scare quotes, because what does that even mean, right? You know, and I think the ultimate irony, the brutal irony of the story here is that this is somebody who is obsessed with this idea of freedom, of living outside the norms of society, the rules of society. But in his endless pursuit of freedom, he ended up, I think, very, very trapped, very, very alone. And I think we often, as people, tell ourselves when we talk about concepts such as freedom, that they mean some, you know, rugged individualism, this ultimate American myth about standing for ourselves and not needing anybody. But when you cut yourself off from other people, bad things happen. And I think this story is in many ways a story about connection. It's a story about how we as people rely on and need each other and what happens when we pretend we can do everything on our own.
Yeah, there's an interesting thread running through his story about his relationship with his family. And it was kind of, you know, I don't like to feel sad for the bank robber who doesn't get away with it at the end. But there's this kind of sad moment at the end where, you know, his family is told that he was involved in a bank robbery. And they're like, oh, is he okay? Was he in the bank when it was robbed? And they just couldn't comprehend the idea that he was a master criminal.
People have two sides. They have a light side, a dark side, I'd say, right? This is something we've talked about so many times. You know, everyone views everyone else differently, and how you are to one person isn't how you're going to be in every other day of your life. And someone like Hollywood, right? He was Hollywood for a couple of hours, but then he'd just go back to being Scott Scurlock. And it was that transition.
Yeah, this guy lived a true double life. And I think to us, one of the most amazing revelations was really being able to uncover what that actually means to live this life, to be Hollywood to bank tellers and to employees, but then to your friends and the family and people who don't know about this other aspect of you, you're somebody else entirely. What does that do to you, that split? And it really is this, you know, walking, talking Carl Jungian archetype. He's the light side and he's the dark side, kind of all rolled up into one. I think one of the reasons this story felt so, again, mythological and larger than life to Morse and I was you're seeing this ultimate struggle of light and dark, of good and bad, play out within this one person. And our goal was to really bring that to life. You know, so in this film, you know, we have folks like you referencing who had no idea he was a bank robber, right? For years, they had no idea. But then you have the people who did know. You have his accomplices who knew very well he was a bank robber. And we also were lucky enough to get Scott's diaries and his journals, which I think really brought to life this internal struggle within him.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the actual reporting and making of this film, because this feels like, you know, this is a reported documentary. This is not, you know, a clip job. It really feels like you put together a full story here. So how did you guys go about tracking down a people who you knew we knew were involved, you know, the police and the FBI and all that, and his the accomplices who went to jail, but also folks who I don't think were really known either to authorities or to the general public were involved with this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have accomplices in this film that law enforcement learned about by watching our film. You know, we report on banks these guys robbed that to this day are not on the official record as banks these guys robbed. We viewed this movie as an act of journalism. I mean, you know, my background is as a journalist. I was a print journalist for many years. And what I love about long form documentaries is it is one of the last places left where you can really spend several years digging into one story as a journalist. You know, we live in a world with a true crisis of journalism, especially investigative and local journalism. It's very, very difficult for journalists to find the time, the resources, the inclination to spend years and years and years really digging into one story. And this was a story that the, you know, every layer of the onion we unraveled, we found something new. And it was very clear to us very, very early into this process that this story had never actually been properly reported. All that was out there was, you know, there were narratives of convenience at the time of the crimes. You know, so the surviving accomplices are telling the FBI some information, but of course they're holding a lot back because that might impact their sentencing, you know, for example. So, and the police, you know, they're eager to put this story to bed as quickly as they can. But given the benefit of a couple decades later, we found people way more willing to be open about things. Statutes of limitation have passed. You don't really have that same lingering legal threat. And so we even had accomplices from these cases in this film who show up on camera to talk about their crimes, who, again, the police don't know about. And this was really, really, really an exciting project to report, because we really got the sense that everywhere we looked, we're finding new information for the first time the public has never heard of. I mean, most people never heard of the story, period. But the people who do know about it are, you know, really had so many questions and so many mysteries that I think we were able to largely answer.
Plus, the 90s are pretty freaking cool now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And
there's definite... There's a definite throwback vibe to this. You know, I spend time listening to the Lithium XM channel on my satellite radio, and it's like the 90s grunge sound. You know, Seattle figures prominently into that, obviously. And there is this vibe from some of the people you talk about, like, yeah, man, these guys were just anti-establishment. That's cool. That's a cool thing that we were all into then, right?
Even this grandma, the cute little grandma who's interviewed, and, you know, she's saying, you know, oh, he's clever, darn clever. You know, I can't imagine that person, but I guess that's Seattle. And Seattle hopefully also comes across like a character in itself in this film from the composite of people and places and things we see. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not just the 90s from like the, okay, grunge aspects. You know, this was a story that took place in the 90s that really, really, really felt like a 90s action or crime movie in terms of just the events, the characters. I mean, our characters, many of them really feel like that's a movie cop, that's a movie FBI agent, that's a movie bank robber. You know, it is a lot of just like pulled from this, from the tropey cliches of the silver screen characters. And that really was a gift to us as storytellers, because it allowed us to lean into, I think, audience expectations of what a 90s action movie was like, and also give us stylistic cues. You know, we wanted to make a movie that felt not like you're watching a documentary, but like you're watching a Michael Mann movie or a Tony Scott movie in the 1990s. And was as thrilling, as exciting as that. And when we're at times, you hopefully sort of forget you're watching a documentary until, of course, the reality of everything kind of hits in.
It's interesting. There are scenes from Heat and Point Break intercut into the film to, I think, give people that sense of mood. But it also does create a secondary question about who in this story thought that they were living that sort of life. Because anytime you talk to cops in a story like this, you see police officers or FBI agents in a story like this giving interviews, it's hard not to think of their own self-conception as we're the good guys, we are the Keanu Reeves character or the Al Pacino character in this story. When you were interviewing folks on both sides of the law here, who felt more like they were a character in a movie? Who felt more like they were doing narrative with this?
I love that question, because while we were doing our interviews, it became very, very clear that just about everybody in this movie felt like they were in a movie when all of these events were going down. And that feeling stayed with them decades later. You know, there wasn't a single person who didn't say to us, this felt like we were in a movie. And I think, as you mentioned, both the people on the law enforcement side and the bank robber side tended to lean into that character archetype, right? They began to feel like they were movie cop or movie bank robber or movie outlaw or movie whatever. And I think that really, really comes through in the interview. And I feel like, to some degree, this is a movie about our capacity as humans to self-mythologize, to tell these stories, to tell these narratives, to see ourselves as characters within narratives and within myths. And I think it also is, to some degree, about what happens when those narratives and when those myths run headfirst into reality.
This is art imitating life, life imitating art. And it's just this back and forth ping pong match of this, you know, that we see in the film. And it's wild, for me at least.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money. But nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Well, and it's also interesting because you cut, if I remember correctly, there's a sequence from Heat that you cut in where Robert De Niro's character is saying, we are here for the bank's money, we're not here for your money, which is, again, the kind of self-justification, but also the way to explain to people, like, we're bad guys, but we're not bad guys. We're not, you know, we're not here to make your life worse or to hurt you. And then you juxtapose that with interviews from people who were in the actual robberies and the actual trauma that they felt. That, and that's an interesting choice. Talk about that a little bit, and your, what the not just the cinematic choice here, but also, I frankly, the moral choice that you're making.
Yeah, absolutely. There were so many people who were traumatized, and then we were lucky to get introduced to Susan Dodd, who was robbed 14 times, including once by the Hollywood Bandit. You know, imagine having a gun pointed in your face 14 times while you're going to work at a bank. That's insane. That's crazy. No one should be subjected to that. And we take that very seriously. Seth, you probably...
Yeah. No, I mean, I think to a pretty large extent, this movie to me is about sort of subverting the myth of the noble outlaw and of the bank robber. You know, I think that people grew up, we all grew up watching old Western movies with stagecoach robberies or bank robberies or movie or action movies like Point Break, and to a lesser degree like Heat, that really say, like, this is a romantic profession, right? This is a way of life. There's something honorable, noble, romantic about being this bank robber. But then in reality, you actually do it. The reality is very, very different. There are real victims. You know, having a gun pointed at you has real lifelong effects on you. Like, that doesn't go away. And I think these guys, these bank robbers, they were telling themselves the story that they were engaging in a victimless crime. And what we wanted to do with this film was to, I think, take that and show the reality of it and show not only is this not a victimless crime to the people in the banks who are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of victims of Hollywood himself, but also to yourself, also to the people you love. Because when you cross that Rubicon, when you begin to live this criminal life, this double life, this life of lies, nobody prepares you. The movies don't prepare you for what that actually is like. And it's a really, really hard and isolating, lonely life, and ultimately one that's unsustainable, which creates that pressure for that ultimate of Hollywood tropes, which is, of course, the one last score, which these guys felt like they had to engage in because they couldn't live this way any longer. And they should have been smart enough to know, you know, if you think, hey, it feels like we're living in a movie, anytime you're saying to yourself, one last score and then we're out, you got to stop what you're doing. Because that rarely, I don't think ever, has ever ended up well in a single movie.
Everything is so meta right now. Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, down to the name of this guy, right? Down to the fact that he was known as Hollywood is itself a very, you know, meta idea for the film.
Yeah, and we that really informed how we told the story. I mean, stylistically, in terms of trying to make this film feel like you're watching an action movie, but down to the animations and the recreations we use. The animations are done to look like Hollywood storyboards that sort of come to life through animation. And the idea being that this is a story in which everybody felt like they were in a movie. This is a glimpse at the movie they all imagined themselves to be in. And yeah, the fact that the FBI called him Hollywood, not actually knowing how much he was pulling ideas from Hollywood movies, is astonishing. And also, from our perspective as storytellers, kind of a gift.
Yeah, again, the whole kind of meta conceit. Let's talk about actually making the movie, because it's an interesting looking movie. It's not your kind of standard typical true crime talking heads thing. That you have some recreations, but you do have the storyboard angle as well. Could you talk a little bit about the production there? The what went into getting the stuff animated? Getting the actual scenes acted, because I mean that's a real production. You gotta put together an actual production there.
So there were so many teams on this film, and there are so many people in the credits for a very good reason. The animations were done by a studio here in London named Studio Orca. They were incredible to work with, and again, they had to fit within these pretty specific boxes that we set out for them to fit in. You know, we need this to look like it's the 90s. We made sure that everything, even in the animations, was as real as it could be to every fact that we were aware of. So I think that, you know, and the same with the recreations we shot those in Vancouver with a guy named Stephen Campanelli, who has worked on loads of 90s action movies with Clint Eastwood. And, you know, so there's style there that was created intentionally, you know, from experts who have actually done this.
Yeah, you know, this is a big movie, and big movies take so many people to put together. I mean, this is like, film is an innately collaborative medium. And I think Morse and I are just so lucky to have such incredible collaborators on this. And my goodness, like, I look at some of the work that our teammates did here, and I'm in awe. I'm like, oh my God, it's like this. You have ideas on paper and you talk about them and you see everything come to life, and you almost can't believe, like, wow, you're just in my brain and you scrape that out and this is what's on the screen now. It's such an amazing feeling.
Yeah. Again, it's also a core team of five of us, Max, Maxim, and Liz, who really were on this for 4 years too. So I do want to give a shout out to those people, because they, you know, there were a pretty solid core team.
Can we talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of getting this made and then getting it to Netflix? So were you guys working on this before you talked to Netflix? Did you pitch Netflix? How did that process work?
Yeah, I'd been independently investigating the story for probably 2 years before I went to Morse and, you know, our friends at Lone Wolf Studios, and we decided to team up on this. And I had just been obsessed with this case as a journalist and as a documentary filmmaker. You know, I started looking into it and really realized very, very quickly that this story had never been told from a journalistic perspective, that almost everybody in the story had been quiet about things for close to 30 years, and that everywhere you look, there is just something ridiculous, something amazing, something impossible to believe, some twist, some angle. And it was a story that kept on giving. So, you know, when I started to team up with Morse and my friends at Lone Wolf Studios, I had already been on this for 2 years. and we brought it to Netflix. It was 4 years ago, and we spent 4 years making this movie. And the reason it took 4 years is because it's a big story that under every nook and cranny, you keep finding new things. You know, my favorite feeling, my absolute favorite feeling as a documentary filmmaker is to find that that person who has a box in their attic with undigitized VHS tapes or Super 8 video or whatever it is that the world has never seen. And then you watch it and you're like, oh my goodness, here is footage that changes everything on the story. And that those sorts of revelations, those sorts of discoveries, that feeling of treasure hunting just kept happening and happening and happening while we were making this movie.
I'll also say we had a little pandemic to contend with at some point too. So that might have, you know, the first couple of years were a bit occupied. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because that does, you know, that does change everything in terms of, you know, how work gets done and the speed with which work can get done. And,
yeah.
You know, how stuff can be filmed. You know, you're putting together actual productions with these reproductions. Were you guys, you know, kind of laboring under the COVID protocols at the time? How did that work?
So when the project started, right? We started filming in 2021, and this was, you know, we had to go to Florida for our first interview with Ellen, and we met her in Florida. And at that time, it seemed like there was no pandemic in Florida, but there was a pandemic everywhere else in the world, which for me, getting off a plane from London to Florida, masked up, this and that, and then seeing everyone in Florida restaurants partying like it was 1999, I remember that was an interesting discovery.
Yeah, no, for sure. What about up in Vancouver? How were things up there at the productions? Or was everything kind of done by then?
Yeah, Vancouver, the actual recreations were shot pretty late in the game. And there were still, you know, mask protocols, but, we're able to kind of get things done without COVID slowing us down there.
Yeah, no, I like asking the COVID question, because it definitely... There are two responses to this. One is, I was working on a TV show at the time, and everything took three times as long, and we, you know, had to spend, you know, 10% of our budget on the protocols. And the other ones were, thank God that's over. That's the other response. Thank God.
Probably a bit of both in our team efforts. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So how has the response been to the movie, not just from... you know, folks watching it on Netflix, where it was in the top 10 movies, and it was, you know, it was a hot new thing. I saw it pop up on the most watched charts off of Netflix as well, which is nice. But also just from the participants themselves, because I mean, I know when you do a documentary and folks actually get to see it for the first time, there is a tendency to either be like, wow, this was great, or man, I regret doing this. And I'm curious how folks felt.
You know, I think we're both very, very proud of the fact that every single person in this movie told us that we got it right, that they like the movie, honestly. And I actually am not sure how we did that, because this is a film in which there are people who have fundamentally different takes about what actually happened, about the reality of the scenario. There are people who on a personal level do not like each other who are in this movie. And I think we did a really, really good job of treating everybody fairly and of treating the truth as paramount. Again, you know, if we had been a little laxer just about factualness, about the journalism of it all, I just know that people who lived it would have let us know. And I just can't tell you how thrilled I am, honestly, that everybody in the film just says, like, yeah, like, you got it right, you know? And that's such an incredible feeling, and honestly, a relief.
Big relief.
yeah, I can imagine. And like from folks who are watching it on Netflix, I mean, have you heard from anyone interesting who was just like, oh, this is great, we love this. What's the general response been?
I think there are a lot of people who think they're gonna watch one thing, right? Maybe when you see a title like How to Rob a Bank, you think you're gonna have, you know, we give you the heisty story, but hopefully we're also giving you some layers of depth. I think there's just these themes that hopefully we're not cramming down people's throats, because they seem like they're, you know, appearing in organic ways as we're taking on this roller coaster through the story. I think there's a roller coaster, and then at some point you're like, oh my God, this is actually getting insane, and we're looping up and down, and what's going on here? And then at the end you're like, wow, that was crazy.
Yeah, I love disarming audiences. It's sort of my favorite thing. I love making people have the absolute best time they possibly can so that they're vulnerable, so that they're open to learning something, experiencing something, feeling something, or feeling some level of engagement. You know, I think what we really try to do with this movie was to show people the best time possible so that when the reality hits in, and so, you know, the core themes of the film hit in, the central ideas of this film set in, you're there, you're locked in, you're engaged, and you're open to them.
Yeah. I want to loop back to one thing you guys had mentioned before about the journals, getting access to the journals, and just on a nuts and bolts level, were those in evidence? Like, how did you get access to that stuff?
Yeah, you know, we spoke before about just finding that box of tape or whatever it is that you just didn't know existed, and you blow out some dust and you find something incredible that changes the story. That absolutely was the case with these journals. We did not know these things existed when we set out to make this movie. But over the course of, you know, meeting Hollywood's family, of interviewing his sister, she at one point was just like, hey, I got a box of Scott's stuff in the attic if you want me to check what it is. And we're like, absolutely. The answer is always yes. And in that box were Scott's journals. And we opened these things up, and he, as a person, his voice just came to life for us in a way that we just couldn't believe. I mean, we were seeing this guy with such an internal struggle, and he was writing about it, and he was really saying all of these things we had thought about, all these things that we had assumed were going on in his head, we could confirm were going on in his head.
I mean, the archival footage is pretty amazing. Again, just wandering around this tree, I could watch a whole documentary about his tree mansion. Honestly, I don't mean to get hung up on this, but it is like, I don't know if you guys have ever been to Disney World, but my kids love the Swiss Family Robinson treehouse thing that they have built there. It's enormous. You go up the whole thing, and this is essentially that. He built the whole thing right there.
My goodness, you're right. I love amusement parks. this treehouse no longer exists. The Swiss Family Robinson treehouse thankfully does exist, and will hopefully exist forever. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about either the making of the movie or the story itself or anything else about how to rob a bank or anything going on in the world. Let's go. All right, let's do this. Stephen, you go first.
Okay, don't rob a bank is my conclusion. There's just, you know, even on a much smaller level, just it's the consequences of crime. It's the things that you have to think about once you commit a crime that are just not really worth it. So that's my big takeaway.
Okay, good. Seth, what's your takeaway here?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that has kept me obsessed for 6 years now. And there's something really amazing about taking your own obsession and putting it into a film and allowing other people to experience it. I just hope that 1% of my own personal obsession here came through into this film and that people walk away, hopefully with a lot of answers, but also a lot of questions, because this is a story that at its heart is a mystery. And the mystery is, who is this guy who is both Hollywood and Scott Scurlock? And we, I think, unraveled that, you know, but I think a lot of it is still left to your imagination as a viewer. And I hope you walk away with all sorts of questions.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you for being on the show today. Again, I've been talking to Seth Porges and Stephen Robert Morse, the guys behind How to Rob a Bank. It's on Netflix now. It's probably popping up on your home screen. Some microphone somewhere is picking up you listening to this conversation and feeding it to Netflix algorithm. It's gonna be right there for you. It's fun. It's interesting, and it is. I will praise you guys for this. It's a tight like 85, 90 minutes. Like
87. You got
there, it. There are so many movies of this sort, of all sorts, frankly, that are much longer than they need to be. This is not one of them. This is a perfectly timed in a nice little
dinner and a movie
nightcap, or you know, you're hanging out at home. Trying to figure out what to do. So that's also very nice. Guys, thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks for having us, Sonny.
All right. And again, I am Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. from plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.